Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FoxBet. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one who does the heavy lifting around these parts, the one, the only Payne Insider.
Good morning.
Good morning, kind sir. How are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad. I am gassed already, so we're going to have to make some magic on this podcast. Have to get some energy flowing here and churn this puppy out.
We may have to get you on the 5-Hour Energy Red Bull Black Coffee kick. Something to try and get those juices going first thing in the morning as we get into the doldrums that is the middle of college football season.
I did a little 5-Hour Energy shot last Wednesday. People apparently liked the podcast more than most. So, sorry to disappoint. No 5-Hour Energy this week. Maybe we'll get it kicked back up next week if this is just an absolute shit show, which it could very well be. Good games, though, this week.
There's definitely some good games. It was the first time all season, admittedly, that we actually had an internal debate about which five we were going to cover. So, spoiler alert for all of you SEC fans expecting a full-scale breakdown of Alabama, Texas A&M, you will not get that on the podcast today. We elected to go with the Big Ten instead. But with those marquee games, Payne, we may as well get right into it. And we'll kick things off early. Fox National Game or Big Noon Kickoff, whatever they're calling it these days. In Dallas, where Oklahoma is an 11-point favorite, total in the game 75.5. The Red River Shootout, Red River Rivalry, Showdown, I don't even know what the hell they're calling it these days. But when we look at this Oklahoma team, you talked about it on the preseason podcast, how you expected them to be markedly better defensively. And to date, the Sooners are only allowing 19 points per game and have held their past four opponents to 20 points or fewer. Maybe a little bit of a swagger starting to develop with that success, but this is clearly going to be their first step up when they faced, well, we'll call it a above average, it's not an elite offense, in the form of the Texas Longhorns led by Sam Ellinger.
Interesting. So this side of the ball, I've seen big improvement from both teams, obviously. Texas offense is actually fourth in overall efficiency right now, which is pretty wild. They finished last year 27th, and then we have Oklahoma's defense, monster improvement year over year. Like, I'm a little surprised at what it's been so far. You can see Alex Grinch, like the fingerprints are all over the side of the ball. Extremely early, guys have bought in. They're 36th in defensive efficiency, 84th last year. So when you have an offense this good, that's probably all you're going to need. But I think they may continue to tick up. This is certainly the toughest test, right? But they haven't played a bunch of slouches either. And so they faced Houston, they faced UCLA and Texas Tech. All three of those offenses are top 50. Houston, when King was still deciding to play or whatever that situation is, that's a good, I think, notch on their belt because Houston's a top 25 offense when King's in. Where the most improvement I have seen with my eyes and what the metrics indicate is from the Sooners' pass defense. You know, Motley has been really good. The freshman, Jaden Davis, he's contributing more than I think anyone anticipated. So you look, and Oklahoma's secondary to this point, allowing 55% of passes to be completed. They're giving up 1.7 yards per pass attempt less than they were a season ago. The one thing that's, you know, a little intriguing here, for as much as Grinch's defense has improved, and I think we talked about this either week one against Houston. Did we break that game down? Or maybe it was the preseason podcast.
No, we did. Yeah, we did some Houston, Oklahoma, because it was a standalone game Labor Day weekend.
Yeah, and what we talked about there, I think, was how Grinch wanted to change this defense and build this defense, and it's all about speed. So you had like defensive linemen dropping like 20 and 30 pounds this offseason to play in the speed defense. Right now, I think because of that a little bit, Oklahoma is susceptible against the run. There just hasn't been teams that are close enough to completely expose that weakness for the Sooners defensively. So it's important that I think the Texas O-line owns the trenches here. Keontae Ingram, he's got to have to be a huge factor in this game. We know how efficient Sam Ellinger is when he decides to use his legs, extend some drives, convert some short yardage situations. That's vital. When Ellinger does drop back to pass, the O-line has to continue to protect him. He has been significantly better from clean pockets right now. He's got 17 passing touchdowns on the season. 16 of them have came from a clean pocket, just one when Ellinger's been pressured. He does get some help back this week, which I think is big. It's going to strengthen two positions. You got Colin Johnson. He's returning. He's going to play more of that outside role. It allows Duvernay to kind of focus more on playing in the slot. If you look at Duvernay in the slot, that seems to be where he's most efficient, where he's most comfortable. He's been dominating from there. He's averaging 3.3 yards per route run from that area. So I think the Texas offense gets some weapons back this week, and they should be able to move the ball here. I really believe that, even through the air a little bit. But the key here is on the ground, right? Keeping Oklahoma's offense on the sidelines, helping your defense out, and controlling the clock, I think will go a long way here for the Texas offense.
Well, and you mentioned the Texas offense. One of the areas that's been a major strength for Tom Herman's bunch this year has been their ability to extend drives. Second nationally in third down offense, matched up against the Sooners defense, who, as you talked about, has been better in a lot of key areas, and one of them is getting off the field, where they're fifth nationally in that particular department. On the other side of the ball, and I don't think it's going out on a limb by any stretch of the imagination to say that there is a decided edge to the Oklahoma offense against this Longhorns defense. And when we look at these numbers the Sooners are putting up, it's rinse and repeat under center. The Sooners so far this season have averaged 53.4 points a game, averaging over 640 yards a contest. Jalen Hurts has accounted for 1,900 plus yards, 21 touchdowns. They again lead the nation in yards per play at 9.7. Texas 85th defensively in that particular department. And Jalen Hurts, no stranger to big performances in a rivalry game. How does Texas even begin to formulate a game plan, Payne, to at least slow down Oklahoma, because you ain't going to stop him?
I think that's the right verbiage there, right? Slow them down, because you alluded to it. It's a mismatch. I think the key here is Texas's defense just has to kind of stay mentally involved, right? And realize that their goal is to win more battles than Oklahoma's defense does, right? Like, if you can create a turnover, give your offense an added possession, if you can hold to three rather than give up a touchdown, those are going to be wins for the Texas defense. Unfortunately, when you look at this, Texas's defense is 101st in the country in defensive red zone scoring percentage. That has to change here. You mentioned Jalen Hurts. He's on another planet right now. It looks like he's fixed some of his mechanic issues. He's got Lincoln Riley's scheme, obviously, the game plan, the play calling, and then Hurts doesn't have to face SEC defenses anymore. Those are all things on why Hurts right now is the best quarterback in the country so far statistically, right? He's got the highest passer rating. It's 32 points better than Tua, who's also having a fantastic season. You look at this Oklahoma offense, they're averaging 1.3 yards more per play this season than they were a year ago with the number one overall draft pick operating
insanity.
Its offense.
Absolute insanity.
Yeah, and you just kind of look at what kind of people perceived Hurts to be versus what he's done so far. And he's been fantastic with his legs, right? You mentioned the 1,900-plus all-purpose yards. But when he's throwing, his accuracy has been great. He's pushed the ball downfield pretty well too, right? On passes where Hurts has pushed it 10 or more yards in the air, completing 69% of those attempts, that's 23% better than when he was at Alabama. Chunk throws, which we kind of classify as 10 to 19 yards, Hurts is completing 88% of those passes. He's also got 12 passes completed that have traveled more than 20 yards in the air. And you look at the Longhorns defense, one of the 10 worst in explosive pass defense. So Longhorns defense has given up roughly 5 explosive passes per game. That's got to change a little bit. The one thing here on this side of the ball, though, that if you're a Texas fan, maybe there's a slight glimmer of hope. The competition Oklahoma's offense has faced hasn't been good, is probably keeping it kind.
How dare you talk so poorly about the defensive game plans formulated by Dana Holgorsen and Chip Kelly?
The 5 defenses the Sooners have gone against so far, their average defensive efficiency ranking is 89th. So this is still a tiny step up for them against Texas, as crazy as that sounds. you've mentioned this. It's really been pretty disappointing, I think, for the Texans defensively. You put it all together, they're 66th in overall defensive efficiency. They're just inside the top 90 in yards per play allowed. I think you mentioned that. Todd Orlando's defense, it's sputtering a little bit. They haven't really been able to create any chaos. They're not really making a ton of plays at or behind the line of scrimmage. 41 negative plays in five games against slightly better than average offenses. The front seven is just outside the top 70 in havoc. I think we knew this was going to be a down defense, right? Because they were replacing nine starters. Now, all of a sudden, they've been hit with the injury bug to the two deep a little bit. So that's had a pretty large impact. The positive news, I think, is it looks like, and you do a bunch of reading as well, B.J. Foster, he's going to be good to go. DeMarvian Overshown will be back on the D-line, although Tom Herman kind of indicated he'll be on a snap count. Deshaun Jameson has been awesome in the secondary. He's really emerged, I think, as their best cover corner for Texas after all these injuries kind of took place there. He was awesome last week, had two interceptions. I think, really, he's the only reason Texas ended up winning that game, because West Virginia, by the box score, could have certainly won that, but Jameson had the two big interceptions. He faced seven targets last week, only allowed 28 passing yards. But again, he was the key to that game because West Virginia outgained Texas by 1.5 yards per play, Todd.
Yeah, and this is clearly the kind of matchup where we talked about it at great lengths on the preseason podcast. I mean, both of us made a strong case for going under the Longhorns win total at 9.5 when it was available, saying that there was so much inexperience in the back seven, and if these guys blow assignments or they're unable to contain Jalen Hurts, I think it could spell disaster in Dallas. I know what the history says, and we're going to hear it all week long, as I'm sure our listeners are. Texas 8-3 against the spread as an underdog the last 11. What's interesting about those 11 games, Payne, they've gone under 9 out of the 11 times. The LSU game, of course, we saw the LSU Tigers cover and the game go over the total. And if we go back even further in this particular price range of 10.5 upwards of 21, Texas 16-8 against the spread over the last 20 some odd years. So they've thrived as a dog. But again, every matchup is a little bit different. Don't become enamored with just some of the history there. If Oklahoma gets ahead, let's see if Texas can battle back. One of the more electric atmospheres you're going to see on game day, one of the few I've actually been to. I would encourage everybody who has a chance to get out there to take full advantage. From Dallas and a rivalry game to Camp Randall, where Wisconsin will put their undefeated record on the line, playing host to the Michigan State Spartans. We're looking at the Badgers, a 10.5 point favorite at Fox Bet. Total in this game, 40 right now, Payne. And I guess the first question I have to ask you, should we have cause for concern with the Spartans' defense? They've allowed 65 points over their last two games against Indiana, Ohio State. Wisconsin is the only team in the FBS this season to score on every opening drive. I can tell you one thing, Spartans don't want to get behind if they find themselves in a 7-0 hole 5 minutes into this football game.
They're going to need the defense to step up. And, I think the formula is simple. The execution probably a little more difficult. I was listening to Mark D'Antonio yesterday, and he was like, hey, this week's pretty simple. It's all about shutting down the Wisconsin ground game. Obviously, I think that's pretty obvious in my mind. I would say every team's goal since Ron Dayne was like rubbing Crisco on his thighs to help get his football pants on. Like, that's been the goal, right? Stop the ground game.
That's a visual I'm not going to be able to get out of my head. You've officially ruined the entire damn podcast with that particular visual. So thanks for that.
You go to bed at night thinking about Ron Dayne rubbing Crisco on his thighs?
You know what? When you talk about Crisco, all I think about is the movie Major League. What is that? You put snot on the baseball? Ain't got an arm like you, kid. A little Bardol, a little bit of Crisco. And if the umpire's watching me close, I'll pull a jalapeno up my nose and get it running.
That's an awesome movie. You can best quote. Baseball. I mean, that typically tends to be your quote movie. Your
best baseball movie
comes
ever.
From all that stuff.
Best there. Baseball movie ever. Not close. No other sports movie I'll ever compare.
Oof. Tough one. Listen. In that press conference, it seemed like D'Antonio just kept referencing the Northwestern game. And, if you look at the box score, it's going to be like, okay, Jonathan Taylor played well, right? He went for like 119 yards on the ground. But I think, now we're in 2019. It's better to look at other metrics, obviously. And Taylor was held to a 42% success rate, 2.6 yards per rush below his season average against Northwestern. Jack Cohn was forced into being a passer on passing downs in that game. 15 times Cohn had to throw in a known passing situation. He averages 3.8 yards per attempt on those downs. You compare that to the Michigan game where like Taylor just runs wild, removes all the pressure from Cohn, and suddenly Cohn only had to attempt 6 passes on known passing downs. So it's really important to your point here that the Spartans kind of get their swagger back on defense. They're in a bit of a funk. They had the poor outing against Indiana where they allowed Penix to complete like 20 straight passes. We mentioned this, I think, leading up to last week's game. It's like, hey, this defense is not really in great form right now. And it kind of proved to be true. They blew a lot of assignments against Ohio State, which led to these explosive plays. You'll look at Sparty's run defense last week. It's actually not terrible. Like, Dobbins only had a 38% success rate on his 24 carries. Master Teague had 14 carries. He was successful in just 29% of those. The problem was it was just like too many gashers because of these missed assignments and poor tackling. So if, in my mind, Michigan State can keep Taylor, you know, under 125 yards rushing, force Cohn to be a passer on second and third and long situations, I think they should probably be able to keep it within this number. You'll look stylistically too, Todd, right? Michigan State's faced 4 offenses that prefer to spread you out, 2 offenses that like to be physical and run the ball. ASU and Northwestern, the 2 offenses that like to be a little more physical and run the ball, Sparty's only given up 17 points combined in those 2 games. The Sun Devils put up 4.2 yards per play and a 37% success rate. Northwestern was held to 3.3 yards per play and a 21% success rate. So, typically speaking, you look at Michigan State's defense, it's built to stop an offense that's more ground and pound as opposed to, you know, spread you out in this speed offense. The other thing that's interesting here, just looking kind of at the metrics, Michigan State's offense is more efficient than Michigan's. And prior to last week, Michigan State's defense was more efficient than Michigan's defense. What were the Wolverines catching in that game? Like 3.5. And we just thought it was like overly inflated. We're like, oh my God, there's just so much value on Michigan here potentially. Michigan and Michigan State aren't too far apart, metrically speaking. So, you know, if you're looking at things like that, you're probably going to land on the dog here.
Well, and you look at some of those things. You talked a little bit about Michigan State offensively being better than advertised. I watched that game against Ohio State, and for the first quarter, Michigan State bottled up the Buckeyes. Justin Fields and J.K. Dobbins really couldn't get anything going, but Michigan State's offense's inability to stay on the field looks like it took its toll, and you wouldn't know that by the final time of possession stats because the second half just kind of played out the string. But you mentioned Northwestern, and not only did Northwestern have some success against this Wisconsin offense this year, they had similar success last year in Evanston, holding Jonathan Taylor largely in check. So Coach D'Antonio will clearly be smart to watch that film, figure out if he can replicate what Pat Fitzgerald's team has done in the past. When we continue to talk about that Michigan State offense against the Wisconsin defense, I know what the numbers say, Payne. Wisconsin has pitched 3 shutouts this year, the first FBS program to achieve that feat since Virginia Tech back in 2001. They have a number 2 ranked rush defense yet to allow more than 97 yards in a game. They have a number 1 ranked pass defense. They've held 4 or 5 opponents to 158 yards or less, although USF, Central Michigan, and Kent State aren't exactly going to confuse you with Texas Tech. And Wisconsin's getting a sack on more than 11% of opposing quarterbacks' dropbacks. Do we think this Wisconsin defense is as good as those numbers suggest, or is this more of a byproduct? Hey, look, they haven't played the most difficult schedule. Every week it's going to step up in class, and we're going to see Jim Leonard's group exposed a bit.
And that's why I'm excited to see this matchup, because I think there's probably some misconceptions about both units, right? And if Sparty can get off the deck after last week's loss to Ohio State, this becomes really interesting because...
Hold on 1 second to that point. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah.
I think they have to get off the deck. And that's one thing in the reading that I found came out a number of times. Michigan State said their conference title hopes weren't dashed losing to Ohio State, but they would officially be dead if they were to drop this game.
Yes, that's the same thing that I saw that, hey, well, the national landscape's probably out of the picture. There's still some goals here that they can achieve. And it seemed like a really full-blown effort so far early in the week at practice from what I read. But to your point initially about Michigan State's offense, to me, I actually watched this game. I DVR'd it. I went back, watched it again. Michigan State's offense, to me, left some plays out there last week. And I know it doesn't look good on paper, and that's why, you know, we have these metrics to see if the eye test compares to the metrics. And so Michigan State, you look, they're held to 4.4 yards per play and a 35% success rate. But they turned the ball over twice early. Elijah Collins in the first quarter has a house call from 50, but his right guard trips him on a pull block. And then down 17-7 in the second quarter, Brian Lewerke has a wide-open Cody White for a walk-in touchdown, a crossing route, and he just airmails the thing. So there was a lot of meat left on the bone, I think, for the Michigan State offense. And in general, like relatively speaking, like I think Michigan State's offense has improved a lot. And you just look season over season. Last year, the Spartans finished 112th in offensive efficiency. Right now, they're 56th, and they faced two top 10 defenses in Northwestern and Ohio State. They faced another top 15 defense in Arizona State, and Tulsa and Indiana are hovering right around 40th in defensive efficiency themselves. So, you know, I think they've played pretty well, relatively speaking. Obviously, it doesn't get any easier going against Jim Leonard's Wisconsin defense at Camp Randall. But to me, and you touched on this, this isn't some like step up in class in my mind, right? This shouldn't be like a shock to Sparty's system if they get off the deck, as we kind of mentioned. And the point that I think is the biggest to discuss is Wisconsin's defense. I mean, they just haven't played a freaking soul. They haven't faced a single top 65 offense to date. Four of the five offenses the Badgers defense has gone against, outside the top 100 in efficiency. Their average opponent rank of offenses faced, 103. So, you know, the total is 39. There's going to be some wind out there. It looks like 17-mile-per-hour wind. I'm not calling for some, like, 40-point explosion from Sparty here, but I think their offense is better than the market indicates, and Wisconsin's defense is probably not as good as the metrics depict, right? So this really is an intriguing matchup for me, especially this side of the ball that I'm interested in seeing.
Well, when you believe in a game that projects that 40 total points score and you have a double-digit underdog, that essentially makes Michigan State's team total right around two touchdowns, you know, plus or minus a half. So an offensive explosion to cover this particular number would constitute 17 points. And I think when you look at these two teams, I won't say they're carbon copies of one another, but for me personally, I don't see 10 points dividing them. It's the schedule that has me a little bit concerned in Michigan State's ability to kind of bounce back from what they had to endure in Columbus last weekend.
What is that? That's out to 11 now.
Yeah. Number keeps leaking, and it gets a game that was on the radar, is off the radar, maybe very much back on the radar as we get closer to weekend kickoff. When we look at the SEC, the nightcap, and we're College Game Day, we'll take things on the road to Baton Rouge. LSU, a 12.5 to 13-point favorite at Fox Bet. Total in this game been bet up a shade out to 55. And Payne, so many questions about this game. I mean, we can start with which team is more battle-tested. LSU beat Texas, but still hasn't faced a top defense. Florida took care of Auburn, but in my opinion, hasn't faced an offense like they're going to see here. The Gators come into this one with a 10-game winning streak, third longest in the country among Power 5 teams. They're 6-0 for the first time since 2016, and they're going to look to do something that they haven't accomplished since 2008, beating back-to-back top 10 opponents in as many weeks. But Dan Mullen's been strong in that department, 3-1 straight up against top 10 opponents, and LSU's schedule, this is the start of a grueling stretch. We can take this game in a number of different directions. Not sure where you wanted to kick things off.
I think obviously the big thing here is Kyle Trask's health, right? Florida's calling it a mild MCL sprain. I can tell you he was walking around with a brace on his knee even yesterday. So, you know, Trask kind of admitted that there was a lot of pain, that he felt the pop. Let's see what he looks like. I would assume, you know, and people probably don't want to hear this, but he's probably going to get shot up. He's going to have a brace on, but, you know, he's going to be functioning, I would think. His pocket awareness, I think, has to improve a little bit. Turnovers need to be limited. He had two fumbles against Auburn. And so, you know, very fortunate. I think we had the reenactment there of the Buffalo Wild Wings commercial last week there, Todd, where the sprinkler head popped up and tripped the player. Derek Brown's got a defensive touchdown.
I think he just got winded. Big fellas like that aren't used to running down the field at that kind of speed.
And that's what happens. The feet get a little lower. There's not as much space
between
foot and ground.
You start to sink in a little bit. You know, the quads start to burn. You go on that kind of sprint, you're looking for the oxygen tank more so in the end zone.
So, you know, we know the Gators' offensive line has its issues, and that's something I think to note here a little bit. I think it probably gets magnified a little bit in Death Valley, right? There's going to be crowd noise. The offensive line's playing its second true road game of the year. Caleb Von Jason is back. He returned last week against Utah State. He's probably chomping at the bit a little bit. We mentioned this last week. In Florida's allowed 46 negative plays so far. They haven't been very good preventing havoc. But I, you know, these are the games I think if you're a Gators fan, it's like, thank God we have Dan Mullen. And I know a lot of people aren't in love with how he's recruited, right? Right now, Florida isn't recruiting at like a top five level like Gator fans want him to. But there are very few better at devising a game plan. And I think that's what's needed here. You know, you have a beat up quarterback, you have a lackluster ground game. It's going to be tough to win with that combination in an environment that, that Florida is going to be in. Now, again, you look at the rushing numbers in a box score last week, they look good, right, against Auburn. But P. Ryan breaks the 88-yarder, right? He seals that deal late. But if you look, Auburn held him to a 29% success rate. P. Ryan's 13 other carries averaged 3.2 yards a pop. Malik Davis, he was successful in just one of his five rushing attempts. So, you know, overall, Florida's offense is going to have to be better this week. This isn't a true freshman making a road start. They're going against Joe Burrow and Joe Brady. So I think that's got to be factored in here. When I look at this, the one spot that Florida might have an advantage, where Dan Mullen needs to kind of attack that LSU defense, is right in the middle of the field. We know how good the LSU secondary is. They've got probably three potential day one picks, right? Delpit, and I think Stingley and Fulton are guys that are going to probably vie to be first round picks. But we preached about this on the preview podcast back in, Jesus, whenever that was, August. And we're like, how are they going to make up and fill the void of Devin White? And so far, that answer is they're not really sure. You look, teams are completing 72% of their passes to the middle of the field against LSU. The Tigers are bottom 10 in both yards per attempt allowed and quarterback rating allowed on passes to the middle of the field. And you look at how Florida kind of designs their offense. It's six wide receivers right now. They're all contributing. All six have 150 or more yards receiving. You can't double anybody. And we saw this last week, even against Auburn's great defense. Freddie Swain sets the tone early, right? He's got this in route over the middle across the face of a linebacker, and it results in explosive touchdown. Trask had a 147 passer rating last week when targeting Swain. So that's the key here. If Florida can attack the middle of that defense, they have a shot here to hang, I think, points-wise with LSU because, you know, even Trask, very good throwing to the middle of the field. He's played five games so far. 42 of his 70 completions have come into the middle of the field. Trask completing 71% of his middle field throws for 9.6 yards an attempt. Five of his seven touchdown passes over the middle, right? And so you have these reliable receivers. They're the best in the SEC on target catch rate at 90%. So if Trask has time to deliver, I think he's going to connect. It's just really important, I think, for LSU's defense and Dave Aranda to come up with a strategy to shut down the middle of the field, obviously. You have a leaky O-line. You have a beat-up quarterback. The plan's clearly going to be for Dan Mullen to kind of get the ball out quick. And that really is where LSU struggled a little bit. And you go back, and I mentioned Devin Duvernay in our Texas preview. He played in the slot. He torched LSU's defense. 12 catches for 154 and two touchdowns. So Aranda can't let Swain and company do the same thing that Duvernay did. They have to figure out how to defend the middle of the field here.
Well, and Aranda better worry about trying to slow down the ground game, too. As you mentioned, it wasn't nearly as effective as the final stat line will indicate. But Dan Mullen's teams have had some success running the football, whether at Florida or Mississippi State before. They've run for 200-plus in each of the last two meetings they've matched up against an Aranda-led defense down there in Baton Rouge. Now, the other side of the ball, strength on strength, Payne, and I think this will be worth its weight in gold as we watch this LSU offense encounter its first true test of the season against a Florida defense that's elite in terms of their ability to get to the opposing quarterback, create pressure, tackles for loss in the backfield. You look at LSU and what they've done this season. They've outscored their opponents 273-99. Best point differential for the Tigers, a plus 174 since 1930, and it's the fifth best point differential in all of FBS. Number one scoring offense in the country, something I never thought I would say as it pertained to LSU. Average touchdown drive, a shade more than 2 minutes, and we look at some of their offensive metrics. Number one in scoring, number one in third down efficiency, number two total offense, number two pass offense. Well, guess what? The best defense they face this year is Georgia Southern. Pretty sure the Florida Gators are going to be a little bit stingier.
Yes, and I'm off my game here because I got the white death screen there for a minute, so I had to
On which computer? I mean, I know you have like 37 computers there, as a pretty akin to a day trader in Wall Street, as people try and imagine what your office looks like. All they see is green juice, 17 different bottles of water. You got the computer screens going. You have Lara bar wrappers discarded there. Am I missing anything?
I think people will be amazed at how much water I drink. So, like, I'm looking at my 30-ounce glass right now. So I've drank two, and I'm halfway down my third. So whatever the math is on that, is that 75?
And
75
I've had
ounces of water?
And I've had a grand total of 8 ounces, which technically violates the fast I'm supposed to be on.
You're not allowed to drink water on that thing.
No, nothing. It's purification.
Really?
It's the Day of Atonement, Payne. And, I, you know, over the last 365 days, you know, there may or may not have been a few sins that I've committed that I have to atone for around here.
Well, at least you're in check now. You have a lovely lady friend, so you're not doing anything unsavory at the club these days. What are you atoning for?
I have no idea. It's not that kind of podcast here. I'm not... you know, going to turn this into a confessional by any stretch of the imagination. But if we go through some of the beats we've been forced to endure betting football, I mean, I feel like I must have pissed on the gambling gods one way or another.
There you go. All right, what are we talking about? I'm completely lost. LSU,
LSU offense against the Florida Gator defense.
Man, the odds screen went white, and it was like the end of the world. So I had to restart that up. The white death screen. Do you not get that anymore?
Oh, I did. I just got it right now.
You just got it.
You know
okay. I was going to say, I can't be the only one that got that.
I'm going to take a picture of it. So you keep talking. I'm going to take a picture of it so people know what the hell we're talking about.
So, love Don Best, by the way. Anyways, I am, when I look at this, it's simple. I think I overheard you saying this as I got distracted. Certainly Joe Burrow and Joe Brady's toughest test today by a long mile. And you look at some of the schedule that they've played, it's five defenses so far that have an average efficiency rank of 84th. Last week against Utah State was actually the toughest matchup until now that LSU's offense had to face. So this is certainly a big step up in class. The Gators are fifth in efficiency on the defensive side of the ball. What's really interesting here, when I think Burrow and Joe Brady kind of pop on the film from the Auburn game, what they likely see is something that they probably didn't expect to see or may shock them a little bit. Todd Grantham's defense played it straight against Bo Nix and Auburn last week. Like, Grantham rushed more than four guys two times on 61 defensive snaps. And everyone talks about how he loves sending the house. Didn't do it last week. It'll be interesting to see what the game plan is here. We know pressure is the name of the game for Grantham. Throughout this season, 124 quarterback pressures. That's translated into 26 sacks, third most in the country. But this is kind of the game within the game, the cat and mouse and the back and forth. Let's see if Grantham, you know, if he's going to dial up pressure against Burrow or he's going to lay back like he did against Bo Nix. Right now, what I've seen, Joe Burrow has been fantastic to date with pressure, completing 71% of his passes, averaging 11.8 yards per attempt, six touchdowns, no picks when under pressure. So he's making defenses pay when they send heat. Other thing here, if LSU's offense wants to kind of, you know, put pressure on the Gators, they're going to have to convert for touchdowns when they get into these money situations. It's the one thing that's really, you know, taken Florida's defense to that next level. They're second best in the SEC. They allow 2.7 points per trip. So that's basically when opponents reach their 40, they're only giving up 2.7 points per trip inside the 40. Florida's defense is number two in the country in red zone scoring percentage. So if LSU can get sevens, it's really going to force Trask's hand, I think, on the other side of the ball.
How good, in your opinion, and I know we talked about LSU, we were bullish on them coming into this season. You guys had them inside the top five before they made that big statement on the road against Texas. Do we think LSU's offense is ready for this particular challenge against Florida, or do we think there could be some growing pains early on that, you know, Florida starts to go, wait a second, this LSU offense is good, but it's not that good. We actually think we have a chance to pull this game off.
We're going to find out. I think this is really the big test. Now, they're obviously not going to face Florida's defense every week of the season two moving forward, right? So I think that's always one thing we talk about. Well, this is a great litmus test, and we're going to find out exactly how good LSU's offense is. Moving forward, they're not going to face top five defense every single week. But it certainly gives us a nice barometer to kind of figure out when they get in bigger games later on the season, if there's some comparables. I think they're going to have some success here. But again, this is a monster step up in class. They're still, I don't want to say learning, but they still have this new offensive scheme. You talk to a lot of coaches, a lot of players. Usually it's going to take, at the college level, 7, 8, 9 games to get under your belt to fully get acclimated to this kind of offense. And we've seen LSU this season. They're about 9% up year over year in terms of their pass percentage. The other thing here, and we want to keep an eye on this, C.J. Henderson, Jawan Taylor, both of Florida's corners are a little dinged up. They're questionable. I would think they give it a go, but they're not 100%. What's the defensive end there whose name is very weird and starts with a Z that's slipping my mind? He's also questionable. Is it Zuniga? That's how you pronounce it?
You're asking the wrong guy to try and pronounce. To try and
you
pronounce
watch all
names
these
here.
Games. I just look at the Excel sheet. So I do,
but I'll openly admit that I don't go through a phonetic pronunciation of some of these names, and it does come
really
back
good defensive
to haunt
end.
Me.
He's also questionable. So there's like three key questionable guys for Florida's defense. So if they're banged up, if one or two of them don't go, monitor that situation as well. But certainly we're going to find out what LSU's offense here is a little bit more. I don't think they're going to get shut out in this game by any stretch. I think they'll have some success. But it's certainly their toughest task. I don't expect this isn't Texas's defense. We're not going to see an outburst like that, I don't believe.
No, and Coach O kind of echoed your sentiments all week long, saying this is by far the best pass rush we have seen. We're going to be tested. Last year, we did not block their pass rush very well. Yep. I'm not, of course, going to do it in Coach O's voice because I'll butcher it.
I'd like to see that, actually, or hear that, rather.
Our guys don't understand the challenge in the teams that we have played. I mean, I can't even do it. I can't go with the Cajun voice. But little to say, LSU knows what they're in for here. Should be a great game Saturday night from Baton Rouge. From SEC country to South Bend, Indiana, where it's the Notre Dame Fighting Irish, a 10.5-point favorite welcoming in USC, a rested USC Trojans team. Total in the game, 57.5 at Fox Bet. And Payne, they're playing for the Jeweled Shillelagh. I think I pronounced that right. I don't even know. 270 straight sellouts in South Bend, the second longest streak in the nation. The biggest question here for these two teams, can USC protect the football, an area where they've been extremely deficient? The Irish plus 10 in turnover differential, USC minus 7 so far this season. High 40s, 50% chance of rain, and USC will look to try and win here for the first time since 2011.
That sounds like something you made up.
The Jeweled Shillelagh?
Definitely. That's going to be the reason why one of these two teams win this game, for sure.
It's a rivalry trophy. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it looks like, but I read that. I feel like I should have known that from all those years playing college football, the EA Sports game where you had all the different rivalry stuff. I don't know what it looks like. I'm going to guess a spear or something. Who knows?
Were you good at that?
I was very good. I ran the option. People hated playing me.
PlayStation?
What was I in college? 2001 to 2005. So yeah, that would have been PlayStation. Yep.
Good for you. Only 4 years. The 4-year plan.
Well, it's better than you in the 4-day plan.
I got lucky. It's worked out okay.
Nah, I think it has, but, I was going to make a joke though earlier when you talked about Kyle Trask's pocket presence. It was probably akin to you in the sorority houses in Tallahassee. just looking around, not having any idea what to do and just fumbling.
Yeah, trouble. Like you and the foreign women.
That's a different story for a different day. Hyde Beach will never be the same down there in South Beach. Let's put it that way.
Oh, what a time to be alive. All right.
I still blame the language barrier for that.
Yeah. Let's.
don't be a dick, Payne. Don't be a dick.
Oh. All right, I don't even know what we're doing. This has gone off the rails. What the hell
are we
talking about?
All right, USC bye week. They get healthy at the quarterback position. We see Slovis is an upgrade. How will they perform against the Fighting Irish defense?
Slovis. Was she a Russian girl? I can't remember.
She was Eastern Europe. She was definitely Eastern European. I don't know if she was Russian, Ukrainian, gotcha. Moldovan, all right, so from Kazakhstan. I don't know.
Keaton Slovis is obviously back. Graham Harrell's kind of talked about it being really important this week in practice to make sure all the rust is shaken off. Jesus Christ.
It's not that funny, Payne.
So from what I have been told, Slovis hasn't really been throwing during the concussion protocol. So again, important for Slovis to shake off the rust. Harrell kind of said in his press conference this week that it actually could be good for him if they can get the rust off by the end of the week because his arm You know, he feels like it's been rejuvenated. He's got a shot of life back in the arm. We'll see. We know two things. That Slovis has really played two, I think, significant times in games. You know, the start at BYU and then the, you know, long relief against Stanford, we'll call it that. You can tell Graham Harrell thinks the world of Keaton Slovis, right? It's not just by what he says, but how he uses him. You know, he's got the game cold off the pine against Stanford, and it's still the same, you know, pass-first offense, chuck it down the field. Slovis was excellent in that game, right? Seven explosive passes. USC's offense was successful in 60% of their offensive snaps against Stanford. Slovis obviously has the tough start at BYU. Really tough environment there. He throws three picks. That can't happen, obviously, against Notre Dame. And it's tough to say this, but aside from the three picks, I thought Slovis played pretty well, right? I really harp on this a lot because it's reality. And it's really important, I think, that Harrell lets Slovis throw on early downs again. In the BYU game, despite the three picks, if you look on standard down and distances, Slovis was 18 for 22. He averaged more than 10 yards per attempt. So getting him to throw in situations where the defense doesn't know its throw is really important. Where Slovis struggled is in known passing situations. He completed 50% of his passes for 3.1 yards per attempt and two picks. So it's really simple. If you see Notre Dame winning on first down defensively, it then is going to force a true freshman into these tough passing situations, which I'm talking about. That's certainly going to be a key. When and if Notre Dame gets USC into these kind of known passing situations, we're going to see their speed defense package. It's their dime defense. They like to put three pass rushers on the field. They get five defensive backs out there. They thought this would be like a huge staple to their defense. From what I have seen, and what's really interesting is the last three games, and I know it's against Fromm and Perkins, but then you had Grant Loy from Bowling Green. The last three games, Notre Dame's allowed 72% of passes to be completed when they're in this dime defense. That's going to have to get cleaned up a little bit for the Irish. We know about the USC receivers on the outside. They usually have a matchup advantage. It's about limiting them, I think, if you're the Irish. Brian Kelly's talked about playing his safeties back and helping out. If that's the case, we need to see USC's ground and pound going a little bit as well. But Notre Dame this season, top 10 in explosive pass defense. They've only given up 9 explosive passes all season. So this is a matchup that USC's receivers are going to have to dominate again and give Slovis a lot of easy targets. So they have to win those matchups outside. And if the Irish are going to hang their safeties back, we need to see a lot of ground and pound from USC as well.
Well, and you mentioned some of USC's struggles. Clearly, Washington employed a similar defensive game plan against Matt Fink, not necessarily apples to apples, but when they dropped 8 into coverage, the young quarterback struggled running Graham Harrell's offense. So I would have to think that was a focal point during the bye week to go, hey, look, if they're going to play this kind of soft zone coverage, here's how we need to go about exploiting it. You mentioned the ground game. And one injury to keep tabs on, I mean, Notre Dame lost a veteran cornerback in Sean Crawford with a gruesome dislocated elbow in the win against Virginia. I don't think it's a leap of faith, or I'm making a bold proclamation here, saying that when you look at the opposing wide receivers Notre Dame has faced, in Georgia we had some concerns about that position group, knowing the youth and inexperience, this is hands down going to be their biggest challenge, because Virginia doesn't have playmakers, and Bryce Perkins still had some success, but he was more done in by the sacks and the fact that he was a chicken with his head cut off in the pocket.
The turnovers in the third quarter drastically changed the outcome of that game. I mean, Virginia covered the first half. They didn't cover the full game number, and it's because of these turnovers. But your point is spot on. Louisville probably had the best receivers that Notre Dame's secondary has faced so far. I mean, they've faced, I think, New Mexico's offense, obviously Georgia and Virginia. Georgia and Virginia, those two offenses, the question marks they had were the receivers they had to replace in the offseason. Then you had Bowling Green last week, so this is certainly a different animal in terms of athleticism, speed, and size, I think, for the Notre Dame defense.
When we look on the other side of the ball, Notre Dame has been one of the most efficient teams in the country. When they get into the red zone, they score touchdowns. They've done been there 20 times. They've come away with 7 points on 17 of those trips. USC, you look at their rush defense, they're giving up 175 yards per game, 4.5 yards per carry. But when I watch, Payne, the one thing that I see time and time again with USC, they're stout between the tackles, but they have a lot of trouble containing the edge. Notre Dame gets arguably its best game breaker back this weekend, Jafar Armstrong, who's expected to return. How do we see this matchup playing out, and do we think USC will have an answer for this Ian Book-led offense?
This side of the ball comes down to what USC defense shows up, right? Are they the defense that's currently 51st in overall efficiency? Are they the defense that went to Washington and allowed 51% of plays to grade successful? That's 10% more than the national average. Or to your point, do they turn their glimpses of being really good into actually being consistently good? And with 2 weeks to prepare and getting guys like Hufanga and Griffin back healthy, USC needs to be the latter defense here to really, I think, pull off a full-blown upset, right? You kind of mentioned Notre Dame's offense. Top to bottom, 18th in overall efficiency. There's been some inconsistency with them as well. The two games where Notre Dame has played really good defenses, Georgia and Virginia, the Irish offense has sputtered a little bit, right? Held below the national average in success rate and explosiveness in both those games. They do get some guys back on offense. You mentioned Jafar Armstrong. I think that's big for the Irish ground game. He's been recovering, I believe, with the oblique tear from the opener against Louisville. I think he's probably a guy that should have had more touches last season. He was more efficient than Dexter Williams last season. Jafar Armstrong's rushing success rate was 8.5% better than Williams. So I think this is a good get back for Notre Dame's offense. Gives them more explosiveness on the ground. We know Ian Book has hit some big plays through the air, top 10 in explosive passing as well. But again, it's just two teams that have been a little bit inconsistent. Which one finds their groove, gets back into form, and can be consistent throughout four quarters here is probably the side of the, you know, the side of the, or the unit on this side of the ball that wins the matchup. That's the big thing here. Really, we haven't seen the Irish ground game get going aside from the Virginia game. Right. I mean, Tony Jones Jr., he had like 7.3 a carry and a 56% success rate. But against like good competition, that's really the only back that's done much. So I think Jafar Armstrong, to your point here, is a good get back. We just, USC's defense has the talent. They're just extremely young. If they can be consistent here, I think they're going to have a shot covering this number.
We'll see if this team looks fresh and rejuvenated. Bye week couldn't come at a better time for a side in USC that had played a grueling schedule, maybe as difficult a schedule as anyone in the country not named Stanford to this point in the season. From South Bend, we'll keep things in the Midwest for a night game at Kinnick Stadium. And this sees Penn State, a 3.5 to 4 point road favorite. Total in the game, 41.5 at Fox Bet. We look at Penn State and Iowa. Penn State, of course, made easy work of Purdue, an undermanned Purdue team last week, and Iowa went on the road. We know we bet Michigan for our best bet on this podcast, but I think Iowa was a little bit better than what that final score would have indicated. But no easy task going against the Penn State defense, who metrically pretty damn good, Payne. 6th in the country in yards per game allowed, 3rd in yards per play allowed, 2nd in points per game allowed, 4th in yards per game rushing allowed, and number 1 in yards per carry allowed. Can Iowa generate enough offense or get enough stops on the defensive side of the ball to make them a live underdog here against the Penn State offense, who did us dirty against Maryland, but still I have some major question marks about?
Yeah. You know, listen, let's start with Penn State's offense. Against Pittsburgh, and again, I think that's probably the data point that's really comparable. It was about big plays for Sean Clifford, right, in the Penn State offense. They had just a 35% success rate, but they were well above the national average in explosiveness against top 15 defense and efficiency against Pittsburgh. The second toughest test for Penn State's offense was one that we'd like to forget about at Maryland. And that was against the 34th best defense in efficiency. Clifford was shit. He was electric, right? I was shocked. He really came along. 84% completion rate in that game. He averaged 12.8 yards per pass attempt. The Penn State offense was successful on 74% of their passes against the Terps defense. This is probably on par when you look at Iowa's defense, right? To me, they didn't show very well against Iowa State. They gave up 7.8 yards per play and a success rate 7% better than the country average. But they were extremely banged up against Iowa State. Last week, we saw Iowa's defense. It was the second toughest test for them. I know Michigan's offense isn't very good. I think they're right now 66th, Jesus, in overall offensive efficiency. But you look, the Hawkeyes' defense was fantastic. They held Michigan to 2.2 yards per play below the national average, 9% below the national average for offensive success rate. I think Iowa's defense is a little bit healthier too, right? They can get back to the what they call their DNA, that 4-2-5 defense. The Iowa corners are going to have to play well here. That's going to be the key in this game. KJ Hamler's speed, his explosiveness, that's going to be tough to match. He's also very efficient, right? But we saw him. He's just an absolute game changer. He was really the game changer in the Maryland game. Ripped out their hearts on those third and long situations. So Clifford really in that game against Maryland, he was only forced to pass four times in known passing situations. Completed all four times. Had 27 yards per attempt because of KJ Hamler, right? Third and nine, we're just, you know, going to bust it for a long touchdown. Third and 11, there was another explosive situation where Maryland just couldn't get off the field because of KJ Hamler's speed. That's going to be the thing to watch on this side of the ball. Can that Iowa secondary match up with the speed here? If they can, I think it's going to go a long way. Also need to have more pressure from the front four. It's been a little disappointing this year for Iowa's front four, not getting enough pressure. It's the one question mark we kind of have about this Penn State offense. We've had it for years, is that offensive line. Sometimes it can be really inconsistent. So Iowa's front four has to get pressure on Clifford, make him throw it quickly. Don't allow KJ Hamler to get separation in that secondary. So that's the biggest matchup. Contain KJ Hamler, get pressure on Clifford. And I think Kinnick Stadium, we have seen at night, has been a house of horrors, especially for young quarterbacks.
I wanted to ask you about that real quick. And we talk about home field advantage. I'm not asking you to peel back the curtain or reveal the secret sauce. I mean, how much more do you upgrade a home field like Kinnick under the lights, giving past history and how electric it can become, as an atmosphere for college football?
I think we're looking at about 5.5 points.
It's a big, big number, and two teams that, you know, it seems like they play almost every year, but in reality, these aren't exactly familiar foes in the grand scheme of things. Only the 10th meeting between them since 1992. So should be a fun one to watch, as we'll see if Iowa can get back in the win column, get their season on track, or if Penn State will continue their undefeated march throughout the course of Big Ten play. Any other final notes that you wanted to add on the Iowa game? I know we kind of touched on it pretty quickly, but wanted to make sure that we got everything out there.
Yeah, you know, just the big thing for the Hawkeyes offense is we need to see the offensive line. And I think last week was obviously a great performance by Don Brown's defense, but a little bit of an anomaly, right? They were getting their left tackle, Lark Jackson, back. He only played like 15 snaps prior to last week. We thought, even though we were on Michigan, that would be a big boost, right? You have to be impartial, but man, you could tell he wasn't in game shape. He wasn't playing at game speed. He gave up one sack and three hurries. So I think another week of Lark Jackson back at left tackle, I think the offensive line is going to look a little bit better here for the Hawkeyes. Nate Stanley was sacked 8 times last week, had 3 picks because of those pressures. But just quickly, this is another step up in class for Iowa's offense. They have failed both tests. I know you look at the scoreboard against Iowa State and say, hey, you know, they won that. But it wasn't very good. 4.35 yards per play against Iowa State. Stanley was held to 4.8 yards per pass attempt against Iowa State. Last week, 3.6 yards per play against Michigan and a 32% success rate. So there's got to be protection up front. There's got to be some movement in the ground game. I know some of the running backs for Iowa, if you kind of read between the lines, are bitching this week because they can't get into rhythm because they're using like 3 running backs. Hopefully that sorts itself out a little bit, but it's all about up front for the Iowa offense. Give Nate Stanley some time. I think he's going to be able to have some success here. I really like, relatively speaking for Iowa, I like their receivers this year. Goodson looks like he's got some talent and some speed. And the guy there with 74 last names, he's been pretty good as well.
Jesus.
So I think there could be some opportunities here if you give Nate Stanley some time.
Should be a hell of a game. 5 beautiful games as we get deeper into the heart of conference play, and we can cut out a lot of the fluff.
Amir Smith-Marset. There we go. He's only got 3.
So there you go. See, I was proud of you. You didn't have 93 names. Guy's got 3, and here you are throwing him under the bus.
I didn't throw him under the bus. I just didn't remember the name.
Okay, well, now you remember. Now you feel better about yourself?
There you go.
All right. Just wanted to check. Five big games all broken down for you as nobody else in the business can do. Follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. You can follow me there as well at Todd Furman. You can also follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. All right, Payne. I'm watching the clock tick away. You said you wanted to get in and out under an hour. We bought ourselves a little bit of wiggle room.
That's not something we're here to. It was just busting your balls. But if you have,
you know,
like,
you tell me you want to rush. You tell me I got to run the 2-minute offense. I got to get things going here. So sometimes I got to melt the clock.
You did kind of press us towards the end there, but I figured it was just more time for you. I know you have an impressive sock collection. You can kind of let us know who in your will is going to receive each of these socks. I know you have a new family member, so. Maybe pass down part of these socks. Let us know who's in the will.
I'm not even sure where the hell you're going with this or how we're going to get there or what you're even trying to get at. So that's what these
we talk about you at the end of the podcast, divulging everyone that's listed in your will.
I don't have a will right now. I mean, I got nothing to give away. A couple of Bet the Board t-shirts is about it that I figure you're going to find a way to throw into a swag
sleep
peg.
Enough. You don't sleep enough to not have a will.
3-4 hours. I figured it'd be a good run when I kick the bucket at 45. I got some time. All right, before I do that, is this the best bet time? Yeah, we'll get to the best bet after that morbid synopsis here that we provided for everybody.
Yeah, there you go. Let's go with 199. USC Trojans plus the 11. You can actually get it right now. Plus 11 minus 06. So reduced juice there. So let's go with USC plus the 11 points. Obviously, we've already broken this game down in full detail. If you're someone who just decided to scroll to the end for the best bet or use the timestamp, we'll try to get this under an hour. So go back to the USC Notre Dame preview. That's where we're at. 11 on plus 11 on the USC Trojans this week.
Let's see if
do they win this prestigious award if they just cover? Because I'm willing to build a second trophy.
Oh, if you want to build a second,
I'll ship them this trophy.
You want to build a second trophy? I'm sure we can send it right to the athletic department there. They can prominently display it in the trophy case at the Galen Center, wherever they put their hardware up.
Perfect.
So it'll be all set. But USC, your best bet.
Put that right next to Reggie's Heisman.
I'm not going to take that one. USC plus 11, your best bet for the Bet the Board podcast this week. Tune in, break it all down, paint any final parting shots, words of wisdom, anything you'd like to get off your chest.
No, that's it. Let's get out of here. My energy kind of started to pick up there towards the end.
Yeah, no, I saw it. You caught your second win after halftime.
Caught the second win at draft. There we go. Let's get out.
All right, we're saving for Saturday primetime. USC, your Bet the Board best bet, and we will see you at the window.